Okay, we're with David E. Worster again. It's September 15th, and we're continuing our review of Robert Carr's book, God Men, Con Men. And we're at the point where Bob Carr leaves San Francisco because he inherited some money from a woman who had appreciated what he had done in Seattle with the Center of Integration in that world. So in this book, on page 105, he is describing his trip to India. And on the way...
That's with Connie.
Conrad Keeler, we call
yes.
Connie. And they are on their way to see Krishnamurti talk. They're both really excited because they haven't seen Krishnamurti since 1960. And they're going to attend his talks in Sanen, S-A-A-N-E-N, in Switzerland. And it is in this period that he meets the other Krishnamurti, U.G. Krishnamurti. So I'm going to.
How soon?
Within that week or so, he's listening to Krishnamurti. So I'm going to read how
okay.
he begins the chapter 8, called The Two Krishnamurtis. He says, he talks about how they travel through Spain and they do this traveling around Europe before they get to the scheduled talks. So now they get to.
Also, I want to mention here that I was told long ago that Krishnamurti was such a common name in India that it was like Smith is here.
Yes, yeah. I think Bob has mentioned that in his book. Okay, here we go. Chapter 8, The Two Krishnamurtis. It was only a few days before Krishnamurti, or J.K., as I was beginning to call him, as many others did, it was only a few days before Krishnamurti would begin his talks in Sanen. It was July of 1966. Now, an aside I'd make is that Dave has retreated from Ralph Doeby. Ralph Doeby has gone to Hawaii and is setting up a more cult-like operation with the organization.
In 66, I don't think he had. In July 66 was when I was offered the Owsley.
Right, but he is going to go to Hawaii within the next few months.
Yes.
Yeah, and you have withdrawn from Doobie's organization of awareness.
Yeah, I did in that spring, probably April, maybe earlier, but March or April.
Of 66, right. Mm-hmm. Okay. It was July of 66, and I was excited that we were both here in Switzerland in this beautiful valley surrounded by snow-capped mountains, a perfect setting in which to listen to this man. Sanen was a small village, and nearby, about a mile away, is Gstaad, G-S-T-A-A-D.
Yes.
A little larger, with hotels and restaurants. There wasn't too much to do but attend the talks and have coffee with friends who had come from all over Europe and the USA.
And I heard it. Does it describe the tent?
Yes, it's in the next paragraph. So,
okay.
Watch the wire, Dave. It's making a little noise.
Sorry.
Yeah, just sort of hold that still. Okay, he says, the talks were given in a large tent very near where we were staying, alongside the Sanen River, beside the road that led to Gstaad. Douglas had never heard. Douglas is a young man they befriended on their adventures. Douglas Rosestone. He had never heard J.K. speak before, and we were all very excited about attending his talks. This would only be the second time that Connie and I would be doing so. Connie was always less excited outwardly, but I wore my feelings on my sleeve. I could hardly wait to see and hear Krishnamurti. On the first morning talk, we sat close to the front so that we would not miss a thing. Krishnamurti looked a little older than he did the last time I had seen him, some 6 years before, but he spoke very deliberately, carefully choosing his words. The people attending the talks were older and gave me the impression that they had money. J.K. talked about the confusion in the mind, that the world is the outcome of that confusion. He talked for about an hour, and when it was over, he left quickly through a side doorway in the tent. As usual, J.K. left us with the feeling that some impact had been made. But when you listen to what he says, it hits you at a deeper level, and you realize your predicament. He is not at all a comfort, and he is not giving you something that you put on a shelf like a flower in a vase. The three of us left the tent and walked down the road. We were rather quiet, thinking about what J.K. had said. We spent most of the time just walking in the hills or going to the village drinking coffee with new friends that were there for the talks. In a way, there was a sense of belonging to a special group, and of course, that ran counter to what J.K. was saying. We had a little stove in our tent so we could cook some of our meals and make coffee. Douglas or Connie would go to the bakery every morning to bring fresh croissants. The dollar was strong, so even Switzerland, with its high cost of living, wasn't prohibitive, and we lived quite well. At night, we played Bob Dylan and the Beatles on a tape recorder we had bought in London. We also played some sounds we had recorded on our journey so far, and with a little help of the substance we had smuggled across the Moroccan border, we floated away in our meditations.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he says these questions were constantly... okay, I should read the next paragraph before I jump. Krishnamurti...
I would like to comment that he mentioned Vivian?
Not yet, no.
But she was there.
Yeah, he meets her at some point, accidentally. They may have already met her in Spain. There was an account of accidentally bumping into her.
Well, she was at the talks.
He doesn't say that.
All right, now I'll tell you something that she told me about the talks.
Okay.
In that tent and everything else. She said that the first thing he said when he came out was, "Why are you here?" And after quite some time, someone asked, "Well, why are you here?" And he answered, "I have to. I would be here if there was just one person." So I just thought I'd tell you that. That was very significant to me when I heard about it. And I think it's worthy of this little time to tell it.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So that he, you know, later when the biography was written of him, he kind of admits that he kind of channeled when he talked, that something came over him before he came out to talk. So it was like he had to relieve himself. He had a certain purpose of speaking, and these things had to be said. So he didn't care how big the audience was, but he was going to speak no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Bob says, Krishnamurti spoke one morning on meditation. He had been leading up to it in his previous talks. And Bob says, I began to question, quote, here's what Bob's thinking while he's listening. What does Krishnamurti mean? What is he talking about? There is the traditional meditation taught by Buddhist or Hindu schools of thought, and in the West there are different kinds of prayer and other spiritual practices. But surely he is talking about something different, something that's not a practice, a ritual, or a formality. He says it comes when the mind is still, but not made still by a system, and is silent and aware of itself. But what is aware? And how does one know it's not just thought, thinking that it's aware?
Now, one thing in one of his talks at Ojai, they were talking about meditation, and they asked him when he meditated. And he said, I never cease meditating. And it makes me think of the Bible talking about praying without ceasing. So I thought, there's an echo there. But
you thought that at the time. At the time you thought of the prayer quote.
I think so. I think immediately when he said it, I got a reference to it. But I understand what he's talking about. As a matter of fact...
About what Bob Carr is questioning about. That's what.
Well, Bob Carr's of the mind still.
Yeah.
There, and maybe still there. I don't know.
Well, what do you mean when you say you understand what he's talking about? You mean Krishnamurti? What Krishnamurti's talking about when he's saying he's meditating constantly?
Well, when he says that, I believe him.
Yeah.
You know, I don't believe anything but that, I think, because I understand it. For one thing, that's what, in a sense, I do, if I can.
Yeah.
I get all these interruptions. but during the day, when I first get up, aside from taking my medicine and a little bit to eat, I put on classical music, and for hours, that's the way it is. Whether there's somebody comes or goes, there's a certain thing. Then I get into checking out the television and the news, But those are just like to kind of get an idea of what's going on, but it doesn't really interrupt my meditation. So I understand what Krishnamurti's talking about, but I understand what I went through in an earlier period that correlates to a lot of what Bob is saying. But for me, it was way back there. It was very brief, way back there. And I think Bob was one of the people who helped me through it.
Right.
Because I had been through that haunted house experience with all that voltage going through me every 10 seconds for 36 hours and getting a handle on even having a life meant I had to be very aware of what I was doing to myself by every word that I spoke.
Yes. Okay, so he says, I finished a quote here of Bob, what he's thinking while he's listening to Krishnamurti, and then Bob says, "These questions were constantly in my mind all morning, and after the talk was over, I went for a walk by myself along the river. My question was, what is this meditation? It's not what the Swamis teach. Then is there something altogether different from the traditional ideas?" So that's what he's thinking about.
Yes.
Okay, then he says, "I had been walking about 20 minutes or so when I saw a man coming towards me on the narrow path. As he approached, I saw that he was Indian, and by his gait and manner, thought he was young. But as he came closer, I saw that he was perhaps in his late 30s or early 40s. Okay, when we came face... Well, let me just say, I think he's talking about meeting U.G. Krishnamurti.
Sounds like it.
And I think the guy would be, according to his birth date, the late teens, so he would be late 50s.
66.
Yeah, 66, so 47, no, okay, 1918, 50 years is 68, yeah, so he's late 40s. So he's looking younger than he actually is, if the date that we see in Wikipedia about UG is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but as he came closer, I saw that he was perhaps in his late 30s or early 40s. When we came face to face, he smiled, and of course, being curious, said hello. Who is he, I thought. Is he here for the JK talks? There was a bench nearby, and we both sat down. He asked me why I was in Switzerland. Oh, I'm here for the Krishnamurti gathering to hear him, I said, and asked him in turn, are you here for the talks? No, was his answer. I live in Seinen, and I've been in Switzerland for some time before Krishnamurti began his talks. Well, I said, have you heard him speak? And he says, yes, in India and here too, he said. So Carr says, my name is Robert Carr. What is yours? I question boldly. U.G. Krishnamurti is my name, but I am called just U.G., he said. We chatted for some time, and I discovered that he was from Chennai, India, the same place that J.K. was from. U.G. lived in a chalet with a Swiss lady, Valentine de Kerven, whom he had known for some time. Bob thinks to himself, I think this guy is interesting. I have to get to know him. So I invited U.G. to come by our tent and meet my friends. He said he would come that evening with Valentine. When I returned to the tent, Connie was there, and Douglas had gone to town for something. I related my encounter with U.G. to Connie and told him that they would come by after dinner. Connie thought it would be nice to meet someone who lived in Seinen. So far, everybody we had met came from some other place in Switzerland. After our dinner of cheese, bread, and pasta, before it was dark, U.G. and Valentine came by.
Now, Valentine
is an older woman, a Swiss lady.
The woman who had the chalet.
Yes, yeah. Who actually is someone he's living with before and continues. I saw that Valentine was some 20 years older than U.G. In quotes, Bob thinks, so I guess they're not lovers. Anyway, he's thinking, U.G. seems different from the other Indians I've known. There's something unusual about him. I just can't put my finger on it right now. So that's what he was thinking as he was sitting with U.G. U.G. looked very much younger than his 48 years. So now he's saying 48, so it is late
40s. Yeah.
Okay. And he seemed detached from things. He was quiet, and I could see that he was very intelligent. When we talked about J.K., he became slightly ruffled. It seemed that U.G. had a lot to say about J.K., but he was too polite to do so then. He told us that he would wait for another time to tell us about his life and why he was living in this Swiss valley. We met U.G. again several times. Our relationship with him went through changes. Quite often, Valentine and U.G. would go with Connie and myself on short trips to Bern or some other town. U.G. would sometimes invite all three of us up to a chalet for a special meal that he would cook, or we would hang out for hours and talk about J.K. and ask how U.G. had come to know him and how U.G. had gotten interested in this line of thought. One day, U.G. showed us an unfinished autobiography that Valentine was helping him to write. From reading the manuscript, his story became clearer. I had a general suspicion about him, but I kept silent about my feelings. Sometimes U.G. would urge us to meet Krishnamurti in person. And U.G. said, quote, it's like being next to a generator, a power plant. You must meet him, he would say. Sometimes he would ask, quote, why do you go and hear him? He can't help you. And then Bob's...
Do they both show up together? Does UG ever go and show up at the same time as Krishnamurti?
Well, this is what's coming up. Okay, so there seemed to be, Bob says, there seemed to be a love-hate relationship between UG and JK, but I couldn't be sure. As for myself, I had no doubt that JK was an enlightened man. As to his theosophical role of being a vehicle for the Maitreya Buddha, that was another matter. In one of his talks... What?
Who said that?
Bob is saying, as for myself, I had no doubt that JK was an enlightened man.
JK, yeah.
And he says, as to JK's theosophical role of being a vehicle for the Maitreya Buddha, that was another matter. In one of his talks, JK said that what happened to him had only happened to a few in the history of mankind. That was too much for me, Bob Carr says. Quote, how can this happen only to a few? What about all the other saints and mystics? What chance is anyone to get it? Why keep going on with this search if one is going to get enlightenment? End of thought. One morning, Alan Noday, Krishnamurti's secretary.
Yeah.
You remember that name?
He came and, yeah, I met him, and he came to Stanford and gave a talk in the Education as Awareness seminar as Krishnamurti's secretary, but he said that it was like, this is private. But he did have the influence and access. And okay, anyway, he's quite a guy.
Okay, so one morning, Alain Naudet, Krishnamurti's
Alain,
Krishnamurti's secretary, announced that there would be a special meeting of younger people with JK at Chalet Tanig, where JK stayed in Upper Gestad. We all thought that this would be a greater opportunity to have more of a real contact with this man. The meetings in the tent were rather formal. There was no opportunity to ask questions. The morning of the meeting, we drove up to the chalet and found a place to park. We were soon sitting in a large room overlooking the valley and the snow-covered mountains that surrounded it. There were about 30 of us in the room. JK quickly entered the room, sat down in a chair, then slowly looked at each one of us. He seemed to look straight into our eyes just for a moment. If this was a stage technique, it certainly worked, as we felt we were in the presence of a sage. That morning, he talked about habit and described how we were all just a bundle of learned habits. And he asked if it was possible to free ourselves from this repetitive way of living. During the talk, I asked JK, quote, how can we change what's there? And that's... Krishnamurti interrupts Bob and says, look, sir, you are trying to find your way home, and you're walking along a path. Someone asks, quote, where are you going? You say, I'm trying to find my way home. And he says, no, that's the wrong way. What do you do? That's the end of what Krishnamurti says. You know, that's the wrong way. What do you do? Bob Carr says, I began to speak in reply. Again, he stopped me and asked, sir, what do you do? Before I could respond, Krishnamurti again asked, what do you do? Are you lost? And you are lost, and you realize that you don't know the way home. What do you do? Your very life depends on finding your way home. Then Bob says, I stop. And Krishnamurti says, yes, you stop. Have any of you stopped? And then... And Bob Carr says to himself, of course not. JK looked directly at me and said, for God's sake, you stop. Okay. What happened to me, I don't know. But after the meeting was over, we started to drive away. I rolled down the window of my car and threw my packet of fresh French cigarettes out the window. I had been smoking for the last 3 years, every day a little more, until I was hooked. There was no thought involved in my action. I knew the habit was over. I could see all the mental images that were involved in my smoking. We drove back to Sanin and had lunch at a small cafe. And after we ordered some coffee, I became aware of my hand as it was reaching for my pocket to get it. To get a cigarette. I saw clearly in my mind how the habit was being repeated, and I just relaxed. We continued to talk and enjoy our coffee. Later I thought, quote, why can't all our habits, the thoughts that make up what we call ourselves, just go away? The next morning, Connie threw his cigarettes into the riverside alongside our tent, much to the delight of Douglas, who didn't smoke. I didn't think much about how I'd stop smoking. Quote, Was it just seeing the habit, I wondered? Then he says, I knew that seeing and being able to talk to JK was far more important to me, and I knew I must try to see him again and break through the wall of people that surrounded him. Bob thinks to himself, these people are all old. Nothing's going to happen to them. They are content with their money and position. The younger people are looking for a change in this world. Here in Europe, Krishnamurti's not in touch with the younger generation. I must go to India, perhaps there I can sit with him and go into the problem and understand what he's saying. That Bob resolved to himself. One afternoon when Douglas, Connie, and I were with UG, he told us about his early life, where he was born, how his mother died after giving birth to him, and how he was raised by his grandfather, who was a lawyer. He was brought up in a rich and influential family. His grandfather was also a theosophist and knew Annie Besant and other leaders in the Theosophical Society. He was a member of the esoteric section, this is the grandfather, known as the White Lotus, whose membership was limited to those who were committed to the masters and their work in the world. The mystical and religious atmosphere that surrounded his home life, dominated UG's early years. Then he said UG brought out a small envelope one morning. Here, he said, here is my NADI reading that my grandfather obtained when I was a young boy. He thrust forward the paper, which was typed in English. He read its contents. UG explained that the readings came directly from ancient palm leaves filled with the writings of sages from hundreds of years ago and passed down for generations.
Yeah.
UG says, quote, there are thousands of these leaves in bundles. When you see the NADI reader, he looks at your palm and asks your birthday. Then he looks through the many bundles of leaves until he finds your leaf.
Yeah.
So UG began to read from the paper, which began by giving the planetary positions of his time and birth. Here's what the paper said. Quote, UG will attain moksha, or liberation, in this very life after intense inner struggle, but the inner crisis will end well. A great teacher who puts him on the right path will help him. In his 49th year, he will be born again. So UG is reading this when he's 48. And he's telling Bob Carr that, you know, supposedly in next year something will happen. So in his 49th year, the NADI said, he will be born again. He will always be on the move, never staying in one place long. And he will live to a ripe old age, preaching all the richness of his personal experience. End of quote. Now, I can say, having read the book, that does happen. Okay, so then continuing what Bob Carr reads, it was hard to take all this in, not knowing much about Indian astrology. NADI reading sounded a bit contrived to me, but I kept my opinion to myself. I was quite skeptical about astrology and palm readings. Later, I would discover that the whole Indian culture is steeped in this kind of thing. Nothing is done without consulting an astrologer. UG was straightforward and seemed not to be trying to impress us with his story. He said that as a boy, he spent his summers away from the heat of Chennai by going to the Himalayas. He studied yoga under Swami Shivananda. He spent long hours practicing all kinds of disciplines. Eventually, he rejected the practices of yoga and meditation. Quoting UG says, the whole thing is a projection of the mind and has no significance at all, he said. Continuing, UG says, I returned to Chennai and finished my education, but I was not interested in what my teachers had to say. Indian philosophy and the Hindu religious myths were of no interest to me. The whole idea of spirituality was finished for me. One day, some friends wanted to take me to meet one of India's famous and real sages. I went along and met Ramana Maharishi at his ashram. I asked him if he could give me what he had, and his answer was, yes, but can you take it? That's what Ramana Maharishi said to UG. UG said that response simply astounded him. How could he have the nerve to give that traditional answer, which meant, quote, this is UG's interpretation of Maharishi, the traditional answer which meant, quote, no, you're not ready. You have to work harder. Perhaps you will attain it in your next life. You are not doing enough now, unquote. That ended UG's interest in gurus and the Indian traditional approach. He returned to Chennai. UG told us that he then got married and as time passed had three children, one boy and two girls. His son Vasant contracted polio and was in need of medical help that could be only found in America. J. Krishnamurti was in Chennai giving his talks at that time, and UG had been attending some of the talks and discussions. During that time, UG had also been meeting privately with JK, and there were heated exchanges between them. This is according to UG telling Bob, right? We don't know if this is in the 50s or wherever. Some of their discussions were about what could be done to help UG's son. UG wanted to take the boy to Chicago for treatments, and JK wanted to try his healing power to see whether it would help. In the end, JK did give him some esoteric healing, but there was no real improvement. So UG packed up and with his wife and son went off to America. Vasant did improve with proper braces and the then current medical treatment. UG's fourth child, a son, was born in the U.S. and they named him Kumar. There were storm clouds gathering in Chicago, a process of detachment, that's for UG personally, storm clouds, A process of detachment from family and friends was beginning with UG, and at some point he sent his wife and four children back to India with what money was left from his inheritance. He then went to New York and later landed in London without money or friends. He managed to live somehow, with no hope or a place to stay, and I would assume this is in the early 50s, okay? He finally showed up on the doorstep of the Ramakrishna Vedanta Society, where they offered him shelter. In exchange for his stay, he edited some of their periodicals. By that time, UG observed, looking back at his life, there had been a deep change in him. The whole sexual urge had gone out of his system. UG said, quote, with it, the wife and so not only the sexual urge had gone out of his system, so also the wife and family. I could no longer be a part of that relationship anymore. It was finished for me. That's the end of the quote. After he UG finished his work at the Vedanta Society, with what money he had, he went to Switzerland, and there he met Valentine, who came to his aid. Eventually, they moved to Seinen, where they had been staying for some years. UG described Valentine as a remarkable woman who shared what money she had without wanting anything in return. So that's the end of his accounting of UG's story, okay?
Of the initial. They meet later, don't they?
Who?
UG.
Okay, this is UG telling Bob Carr in July 66, through many conversations, Bob Carr is summarizing what he learned and how UG ended up in Seinen for the last few years as of 1966, right?
Mm-hmm.
The years before 66. So Bob is telling us about his meeting with this UG guy, and he's getting to know him. So now we know why UG is in Seinen. And we know that he had worked with the Ramakrishna Vedanta Society in London. Okay, now Bob brings us up to the present of the summer of 66, and he says, one day it was raining hard, and to escape getting wet, Connie Douglas and I called on a new friend, Fildea, an American woman, who had rented a condo apartment that was on a hillside overlooking Seinen. We were all holed up there to wait out the rainstorm that was pouring down. I was looking out of the window when I noticed UG walking in the rain along the road that led to Gstaad. A tan-colored Mercedes sports car pulled up by UG. Krishnamurti was behind the wheel. So Bob's observing this from the apartment they're in.
He sees the two getting in there together.
Yeah, he sees, it's his first time he's seeing them together. And it's raining, and UG's walking along. Krishnamurti is driving a car, and he stops.
Krishnamurti loved Mercedes, big cars.
Right. So Bob Carr writes, there were some words exchanged, and then the car sped off, leaving UG standing in the rain. The next day I saw UG, and during our conversation I asked him why he didn't accept a lift from JK. UG looked at me quite astonished and asked, how did you know that? And Bob Carr goes, is it true? You know, some people think that I'm a psychic. And I smiled. So Bob Carr plays this little joke with him. Is it true?
Yes.
You know, some people think that I'm psychic. UG responds, yes, he pulled up alongside me, rolled down his window, and said, hop in. Bob Carr says, what happened? I asked. By now, Bob Carr is saying, UG was not at all sure as to how I knew of this incident. But UG continued. He tells Bob Carr what he said to JK when JK said, hop in. He said, no, thank you. I would rather walk in the rain. JK responded, according to UG, suit yourself, and drove off, leaving UG in the rain. Bob Carr says, I could no longer hold back and said that I was not really psychic, but saw the incident from Phil Day's window. So then Bob Carr says, I felt somehow that UG was finished with that man, meaning Krishnamurti, though they both knew each other so well. I knew that UG had a great admiration for the man, for Krishnamurti, for JK, but he somehow felt that it was necessary to cut himself off from JK so as to be finished with that part of his life and be truly on his own. UG told us that while listening to one of JK's talks in India, he had a mystical experience which produced a tremendous realization for him. He felt that he came close to death, that the structure of his self-identity was dissolving, that with this there was a sense of fear that he was coming to an end. The experience shattered UG and seemed to reconfirm what mystics down through the ages had experienced. But UG was not satisfied. He felt that what he experienced was a distillation of the past experiences of others. He felt he had not gone all the way to the end, and he was not interested in living in something that belonged to the past. So that happened years before, right? Years before 66, he had this mystical experience listening to Krishnamurti.
And he's 47 and will be 48 the next year.
No, he's 48.
Supposed to be born again.
He's 48. When he's 49 in 1967, he will have a cataclysmic experience.
Oh, I see.
But he's telling, when he's 48, the year before, he's telling Bob Carr about how he had a mystical experience with J.K. at his talks years before. But he was not happy with where it led him. He was saying that it was all something that belonged to the past. You know, the great mystical experiences. So then Bob writes, UG spoke to J.K. about this experience, about his experience. And J.K. answered, quote, "If it is real, it will live and act on you. And if it is something dead, it will pass away."
Yeah.
End of quote. UG's own response was to want to see for himself the truth of what he experienced. Okay. So then UG says to Bob Carr, "I could have been a spiritual teacher on my own and become famous," UG said, based on that experience he had from Krishnamurti. "But I put the idea aside as just another illusion I would be adding." I'll read this again. "But I put the idea aside as just another illusion I would be adding to mankind's hope of finding the truth."
Yeah.
Yes. And UG continues telling Bob Carr, "The majority of those who reach this state that I experienced think that they have reached the final goal and believe that they have attained liberation. But unfortunately, there is no measuring stick to differentiate between the few who have attained and those who have gotten stuck in the mystical experience." So there's no measuring stick between those who attained the...
Well, it's a moving... It's like the phrase, "The moving finger writes and moves on."
Having written moves on.
And having written moves on. But during the awareness years, there were people who would always want to have a position, and I would quote this to them, because as soon as you want the position... The energy of awareness is gone, and if you're interested in awareness, you're not going to seek a position. You're going to follow the moving finger that's writing.
Okay.
In other words, there's no destination. You cannot achieve and rest on it, because awareness is in movement, and if you're not in movement, you will not be in awareness.
Yeah, I think UG might agree with you. If you meant beyond thought, which you do, so that's that. Okay, so UG, he continues, UG recounted that when he had asked JK if there was anything behind JK's verbal abstractions, JK answered by saying, quote, "You have no way of knowing," and then changed the subject. UG told Bob and Connie, "That did it. I was through with this man. And what happened? I landed on my own 2 feet. It was the first time in my life that I was truly on my own. After that moment, I never sought advice on anything I was capable of using." He's got this mixed on. Was I capable? After that moment, I never sought advice on anything I was capable of doing myself, or something like that. And it's a bit garbled. This,
I get it. Well, it's like with the awareness. It was suggested that no one asked something that was already known just as a test, that it was a waste of energy and would be dealt with as such. So only ask things that you don't know.
Right. It's actually, the Evergreens did that to me once. Same situation.
Huh?
The Evergreens did that exactly to me.
We'll see how they are. Huh?
Yeah, I was testing them, and they... And
see how you are.
Yeah, and they said, "You've wasted 4.5 minutes, Bob, testing us." And
yeah.
Then they went into some stuff. So anyways, so he says, "I never sought advice on anything. I was capable of using any person," something like that. So basically, he did not ask advice. So then Bob Carr says, "I could not find any contradictions in the way UG lived." In other words, he noticed the guy seemed to live that way. "However, I told Connie that I thought this man, UG, was in a corner. Not that he put himself there, but that there was no way out for him." So then he talks about he and...
No way out but up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Okay, good. So he then says that he and Douglas and Connie had come to know this interesting and quite remarkable person. Little did I know that some years later, it'd actually be 13 years later, about 1979, I would see him again and come to know him as a totally changed man. So he, you know, this is Bob met him, luckily, before he was changed a year later.
So and in juxtaposition to Krishnamurti, Jay Krishnamurti.
Yes.
Okay, that's something I didn't know all about. I know a lot of it, but okay, go ahead.
Well, yeah, what's interesting is that Bob was predestined to track Eugene in his life because he remarkably saw that encounter, private encounter between Eugene and J.K., you know, after Eugene had rejected Krishnamurti. Remember, at the point where he said he had asked Krishnamurti what was behind his verbal attractions, and he said, "You have no way of knowing," and then changed the subject, Eugene said, "That was it. I was through with
it." Yeah, one time when Bob was talking, and I acknowledge that I'm not sure which Krishnamurti was talking about, because he had been talking about both, but he used the phrase, trickster, both of them. And I looked at him, and Connie laughed, and said, "Yeah, trickster." I thought it was J.K. that they were referring to, because I didn't know anything about the story of
Eugene.
But they also talked about this Eugene, and he said, "He's a wild man."
Right. Now, that's exactly what Bob goes on to say. And I would say that would be a conversation not in 73, but in 86, because he doesn't know he's a wild man in 66, 73. So when you see Bob Cargan in 86, that's after he has seen the new wild man, UG, in 79. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I gather when he's talking, he had a whole bunch of pictures. I probably even saw a picture, because he had all these pictures. And he and his boyfriend were there, and they were... That's when he told the boyfriend, "Well, this is the guy who gave me the acid and stuff, you know."
Right.
And,
no, that.
And he said, "Oh, really?" And anyway, they're talking and laughing, and giving each other looks, and it's like talking about this Krishnamurti. Oh, he's a wild man, and I gathered that it was this other guy, and I thought, "What is this schizophrenic trip going on here?"
Yeah. Thinking they're talking about the same guy, and they have different views.
Well, it seemed like a schizophrenic situation either. I even suspected Bob, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't have time to look into that. Well, anyway, go ahead.
But, yeah, definitely you saw something odd was going on the way they were referring to what you thought was one guy, you know, and there's this other thing going on, but another guy.
I kind of figured it was another guy, sort of, but I didn't get the full trip, so I'm getting it now.
Right, and this is 22 years later, 2008. Now the
click.
Now you mentioned pictures. He does have in this book pictures of Eugene and Paul, you know, his young lover, and Robert with Eugene and. In Bangalore in 79. So probably they showed you these
and
pictures.
And is Connie in there?
No, none of Connie.
Okay.
But of Paul, the young guy.
Yeah. What I'm thinking is that somewhere around there, I think Bob may have sold his restaurant before going to... No, in 86 he hadn't sold it, so it would be later. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so yes, there are pictures of Eugene in 79 in Bangalore, India, and Eugene and Robert Carr and Eugene and Paul Arms, who is Bob Carr's new lover. You know, Connie's not at part of that scene.
I didn't see Connie that day.
No, Paul in 86 is... Bob Carr's lover.
Yeah.
I don't think Bob Carr and Paul Arms are lovers in 79, and Bob Carr is still with Connie. In 79, right? Okay?
Oh yeah. The thing with Paul Arms must have happened around 86 or earlier.
Yeah.
And they still had the restaurant, and then later it's sold, and then I don't know what happened.
Yeah, around 86, Bob describes it, they have a real problem with Connie's drinking, and he eventually is removed or bought out of the restaurant.
He told me that, but But I felt it was a power play, and he took it.
You said, and, who told you? Bob or Connie?
Bob did. But when I saw Connie, he didn't look that bad. And but he was, because I had just come from Connie's, I think he was fairly...
You just came from Bob's? No, you just came from Bob's.
From Bob's, yeah, and he was fairly...
stern?
Stern-looking, and was not... We didn't dialogue very much, and it's like we might have stayed, except he was going to do something else, so what we did is we just unhooked the MG from the Buick and went out on the town, came back and reconnected him and hauled ass up 30, 40 miles and camped. But we had...
We had sort of assumed
that we would have stayed at Bob's, but when I walked through the house, I noticed that the bedroom, that the doors were open, had all the bed clothes just pulled up from every direction into a clump in the middle of it. And I thought, I figured it out. He didn't want it. I think he thought that we were trying to move into something because we had so many clothes hanging in the Buick, but they were all leather coats that Paul Seibel was taking up to his relatives because he'd gotten a big deal of a guy he worked for who owned a leather store and was closing, so he gave him all these. And of course, when Bob saw all that, he must have put his mind together, and that was that. So we felt... kind of bad about it, but we decided we weren't going to feel bad about it. We were going to go out and celebrate, so we did.
Yeah, you're saying when you were visit Connie, he was stern. Connie did not go out to town with you.
No, he had some people coming, he said.
Okay, so you and Paul Seibel went out and then came back, had this clothing thing happen, and then...
We already had the clothing thing had happened before.
Right. Okay.
Before we ever left. When we left Bob's, we never went back.
Right, and there was this awkwardness. You're in between Bob and Connie, and Bob and Connie have sort of split, maybe, and you're...
Yeah, and we didn't know, and we didn't probe much further.
Right, you didn't know they'd split, really, at that
Well,
point.
I knew they had. But as far as the... I knew that Bob was going to get him out of that restaurant.
Okay, so you knew the discomfort, and you weren't going to go into it, and it made you feel bad that you couldn't relate to them deeper, but that you weren't going to worry about it, and you left.
Well, we were on a trip.
Right. You were going on up to Vancouver. You were going to see Paul Shockley. You were going to see Paul Shockley after that, and then go up to Vancouver. Okay, so we're... So these... I'm going to go back to what I was reading. Why were we talking? Why did we go on into 1986? Oh, they just said that schizophrenia when you heard them talking about Yuji, right.
Yeah,
and so that Yuji, okay, so Bob is saying, little did I know that some years later I would see Yuji again and come to know him as a totally changed man. It's true that there is no measuring stick to tell what happened to him, but he wasn't then the same man that I knew in Switzerland some 12 years before. So he's saying, in 1979, it's true that there's no measuring stick to tell what happened to him, but he wasn't, in 1979, the same man that I knew in Switzerland some 12 years before.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it'd be 13 years before. It was 1966. Okay. The talks came to an end in September. It was time to leave Switzerland and continue our journey to land, ultimately, by hook or by crook, in India. So, it said, Douglas thought that he would travel overland to India as well, but by now he was hooked on Krishnamurti. He wanted to see Krishnamurti and explore what to do with his life. Now, it's interesting, they meet this young guy, Douglas. And
it's interesting that Robert's middle name is Douglas. Robert Douglas Carr.
Oh, yeah. So that he's talking about this kid that they meet and get Douglas hooked on Krishnamurti. But Douglas, Bob is writing about him because Douglas ends up in America and becomes part of their life with Yuji and is an important person later, you know. So
he is.
Yeah, in retrospect, he's an important person in Bob Carr's life, is a longtime friend. So in retrospect, he's talking about these people he meets, and you might wonder, well, why talk so much about them? Well, they do end up still being in Bob Carr's life later, you know, as the book unfolds. So he says Douglas wanted to see Krishnamurti explore what to do with his life. Connie thought we should buy back Douglas's interest in the camping setup that they had done, and I agreed. Douglas set off one morning after we said to each other goodbye, quote, goodbye, we hope to see you later, maybe in India. And end of quote. It was getting cold at night, and UG invited Connie and myself to stay in a chalet for a few days. We left UG in Valentine, so he didn't describe what went on there. We left UG in Valentine and drove to Italy, staying overnight in Milan, and on down to Rome. So they go on, he describes his traveling on the way to Bombay, which now is called Mumbai. Okay?
Yes.
And he says, we arrived in Mumbai near the end of September. Now, he goes into a lot of stuff about interacting with Krishnamurti and all that, but he meets, I wonder where we go next. There's a lot of details of his learning a lot from J. Krishnamurti, but what's going to happen is later when he gets involved with UG, Bob Carr, quote, you know, sort of rejects Jiddu Krishnamurti under the effect of meeting UG. That's going to be
his second incarnation, huh?
Yes, he gets more involved in the second incarnation of Jiddu via UG Krishnamurti, and that's what's interesting. You find out a lot about this UG Krishnamurti, and going back to what Nadi reading said.
Yeah.
Let's just find that. Okay, so where was I?
And now? you're talking about the one for UG Krishnamurti.
Yes. The reading of that, I'm in light of how Bob gets involved with
did Bob report that he went and had it done for himself? I thought he told me that he had.
I don't know. Maybe I forgot about that. It might be in the book.
Maybe he told me about that they had that, and I assumed he had.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is, he reconnects with UG in 79. He's a different person. And then he gets very involved in UG's life. And
after it... Now, wait a minute. After 86, he meets him again.
No, he meets UG in 79. 12,
As
13...
As the changed person.
Yeah, as a changed person. And
I see. That was before the 86 meeting. Okay,
yeah.
All right. Excuse me. I had to straighten it out.
And he definitely feels that UG is a wild man. Though the second, you call it the second incarnation. I thought you meant of Krishnamurti, J. Krishnamurti. No, yeah, the second incarnation of UG, he's a wild man.
Uh-huh.
But he's a teacher. And the description of the Nadi, when you read through the rest of the book, you see that this description that the Nadi gave to UG when he was young is exactly what happened. It says he will attain moksha liberation in this very life after intense inner struggle, but the inner crisis will end well. So that would include UG's mystical experience. And the Nadi says a great teacher who puts him on the right path will help him. That's obviously J. Krishnamurti. In his 49th year, he'll be born again. That happens. Now, that could have been all put as a suggestion in the young UG's mind, right? You know, and that it happened at 49. I assume the...
Well, astrologically, the 49 years fits into two moves of... In other words, when you're born, Saturn is a certain spot in the sky. And it takes... 28 and a half, or is it 29 years, for it to cycle around to the same point. So you have these different cycles. If you complete everything you're supposed to in that time, then you start out fresh. If you haven't completed, you've got to use up part of your next cycle to take care of what you didn't take care of. And here there's like two cycles there that's 49 years. And that correlates, that precision correlates to the moment that Laverne Harold Christensen and I met at 11:44, January the 28th, 1949, and he died precisely to the minute 49 years later.
After you bet, yes.
Yes, from the time we met to the time he died was precisely 49 years to the minute.
Right. Now, did you say that the cycle was 49 when you first started saying this, quote, paragraph? I missed the first number. Did you say the cycle is 49 or 28? What was the very
first? No, it's take 49 and divide it by 2. I think it's 28 and a half or 29 and
no,
a half.
No, 24.
You did it.
Yeah, half of 50 is 25, so 49 is 24 and a half. 24 and a half years twice is 49.
Oh, wait a minute. There's one more 7-year cycle after that.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You're talking the 2.
7 times 7 is 49, but there's one more cycle that ties in correctly with the Saturn moves. Okay. Go on. I flubbed the dub there, but not exactly.
Yeah, it's the 56 year, 228s that you're talking about to make.
Yeah, I think
years.
So.
And what's interesting though is in 1986, when you see Bob Carr in the summer of 86, that's after the Challenger exploded, I think, on January 28th. Vern.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Vern's because birthday. I was still... See, in 86, after that happened, on July the 4th, is when I left Lake Elsinore.
In California.
And I went over to Laguna Beach and celebrated, and then decided to head up to Hollywood where this producer was going to meet me in this house on Mulholland Drive, just off of Mulholland Drive. Anyway, I leave Laguna and I'm on Highway US 5 for only a few minutes, and all of a sudden I think my tires are going or something because the car starts to rock. But the radio tells me that there's an earthquake, and they're having fun with the earthquake, and I'm having... So I get over to the side of the road and wait until the earthquake is passed, and then I go up to this house, which is sitting on stilts, but it's still there, and he tells me, this producer tells me that he's just taken our friend, who was a writer... Because he was complaining so much, he took him back to Palm Springs. And just before he left, he told him, he says, look, you got to get shaken up. So anyway, he comes back, and he's back at Hollywood when the earthquake occurs, and I'm there, and this other guy's over there, so it's a great big triangulation. But the distance from that guy's house to the epicenter was 6 miles.
Mm.
And you remember that other 6-mile thing in relation to Winston Turnbull, another time where an earthquake occurred 6 miles from his house.
Yeah, and
when I had said he's got to be shaken up.
That's right. That's in 2001. Yeah. Right. So, but the point is, you're saying that what's the date of that? What's that got to do with the Space Challenger?
It was that move that was caused for the Space Challenger, and all the things that happened to me up until July the 4th when I got out of there. And when I got out of there, it's like I really let go. And so I think that was part of the earthquake too. You know how we had those earthquakes,
yeah,
in synchronicity.
Yeah.
The okay. time that we were on the air.
Yes. Well, maybe we should go into this a bit just to explain the sequence. Bob Carr meets Eugene in 79, and then is very involved with him through the early 80s. So by the time you see Bob Carr in the summer of 86, right?
Yes.
They're talking about the two Krishnamurtis in front of you, and it's confusing to you, but you don't know, you don't get the whole story. But when you see Bob Carr... That is the period you've released from. And what you've released from is January 28, 1986. Your lover, Vern Christensen, his birthday...
Did you say January 28th and 98 was when Chris died, but did the space shuttle blow up on the 28th?
Yes, I just...
Oh, my God. I knew there was one more January 28th somewhere, and that's what it is?
Yeah.
Well, is... Oh, my God, I'm getting a rush because all of a sudden it's just like... You remember when I told you the RAI is something you haven't used for a long time? You got to put it back in there.
Yes, RAI and RAI.
Okay, yeah. I've gotten a flash just as strong on January the 28th. Oh my God! Wow! Now see this whole trip that we're having going through this, getting flashes of recall, is very, very good for me. I hope it's good for everybody else that tunes in, especially Bob Carr, that in the sense of grounding in actual recall, which is the same thing as having a long path that you can light up and be in anywhere of that path, and it's present time when you're there, so it isn't a memory, it's a recall. And here... I have been getting recall after recall because you've been triggering them off in such a manner that it's almost lighting up my life a little bit here, a little bit there, and I think it's even helped me, my body, physically.
Great.
In quite a few ways.
Okay, yeah. See, the interesting thing is you meet, we'll go into this a bit, you meet Vern Christensen in January 28th, 49. You meet him on his birthday. Okay.
No, I meet him. No, his birthday is November the 5th.
Oh, okay, so you meet him on January 28th, 49, and he dies on January 28th, 49 years later in 1998. Okay, to the minute. The interesting thing is you talk about the 37-year circadian cycle, or the 37-day, or the 37-hour.
37-hour and 21-day, and then there's... You can look it up on the internet. The circadian cycle is really incredible, fascinating, and if you find the guy that gave me a lot of the information used to be down in Southern Oregon, and he is really, I can't remember his name, but I'm sure it'll pop up on the internet. You start getting into circadian rhythms, and it's worth your while.
Right, because here it is, you meet Vern Christensen, and then in January, the middle of January, in Lake Elsinore, somebody's messing with your dog. The dog disappears. If you don't get back, you're going to make 40 moves.
Four moves.
On your chessboard. And
that each was worth $10 million. $10 billion, I said, didn't I?
Yes, $10 billion. Total of $40 billion would damage somebody. Somebody's going to have to deal with the $40 billion deficit if you make your four moves. I taped that conversation. We broadcast it...
Friday.
No, wait a minute. What happened is a week or so later, January 28th, the Space Challenger blows up. And we decided that was the $40 billion.
And I told you, no, that's only four.
$4 billion?
Yeah.
Okay, only four. And we taped that. You're responding the night of the Challenger about, hey, this is what happened as a result of your complaint a week before about the dog being disappeared, no one dealing with it properly, the sheriff and all that. Well, we taped that, and then we played that sequence a few days later on CKLN Radio with Dave Neufeld, who was the news director, and while we were playing, you commenting on how maybe it had something to do with the Space Challenger going off because your problem the week before, while it was being broadcast on CKLN, Dave Neufeld interrupts the broadcast and says, we just had an earthquake in Toronto.
I was also talking about earthquakes that time. You asked me to talk about earthquakes that time.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about it when it actually happened.
Yes.
There.
I had noticed back in 76 that when we get together from 76 on, there'd be earthquakes or some big disasters when we got together after a period of not being together. And so while I don't think I said that on the radio, but the syndrome came up again because we're playing about how the relationship of you and the Challenger blowing up on Vern's, on the day you met Vern, on January 28th, a few 2 days they were playing, and an earthquake, which never happens in Toronto, occurred while the broadcast is happening.
And Bob Carr's birthday is January the 29th.
That's right.
1928, same year I was born.
Right. And so we have those two, you know, Vern and Bob Carr juxtaposed like that. What I just noticed is that is January 1986 is 37 years after January 49.
Oh.
There's your circadian number.
Yes.
Okay, so we're saying that you went through this tension from January 86 to July 86, and then you're released.
Yes.
This is the point. You're released.
And it took a lot.
It took a lot, yes.
And if I tell you that, that's a long side story. But
we'll do that but maybe later. But the
okay. It's a powerful side story.
Yeah, and the point is that in July, you're leaving Lake Elsinore, and you go to Laguna, and then when you leave Laguna is when you're driving up and the earthquake feeling happens, and then you go and meet the guy in Hollywood, and he tells you...
And he tells you that he told the other guy, whose name I forgot, but the writer, he says, you got to get shaken up. Well, here's the interesting, I said triangulation.
Yeah.
Literally, from... let's see. From Hollywood to Palm Springs is 72 miles, a half of 144.
Yeah.
And from... Wait a minute. No, I'm sorry. The distance from Lake Elsinore... Hollywood is 72. The distance from Lake Elsinore to Palm Springs is 72. The distance to San Diego is 72. So it was right in the center. In order to go, if you went through Lake Elsinore to go either of these places, you'd travel 144 miles. Anyway, it was like a geometrical structure of a tetragramma, a tetrahedron.
Yeah.
And so when I pulled my, I got a story. I got to tell this.
Okay.
This is about a priest has his first client come in for to confessional, and as a little girl who is very rich, and so she tells him that she has been fornicating, and so he. Asked her with whom. She says, well, with Johnny Green. And so he tells her to put $100 in the cash box and say 100 Hail Marys and she'd be forgiven. Well, then a little poor girl came in and she said the same thing, and he told her to put $5 in the cash box and 5 Hail Marys and she'd be forgiven. And then the next visitor was a guy, it was Johnny Green. He says, are you going to split 50-50 with me, or I'm going to take my prick out of your parish.
Okay, you might say I took my prick out of the parish of Elsinore, and the earthquake occurred on